You're listening to WGXE's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane, and today is Thursday, March 7th, 2019. On today's show, we'll be talking to Hudson resident and 3rd Ward Common Council candidate John Darby about his experiences as an Airbnb host. First up, though, Hudson area filmmaker David McDonald talks about his latest project, a screenplay about jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald's formative time at the New York State Training Center for Girls, a women's prison on the site of the current Hudson Correctional Facility, and its effect on her musical career. Every day, volunteer programmers like myself and the WGXE staff work to bring you community content from local leaders, artists, writers, and involved citizens. But without your financial support, this programming simply would not be possible. WGXE is currently running our Radio for Open Ears pledge drive, and your continuing support means we get to produce content that shows the vim, vigor, and vitality of our Hudson Valley communities. To donate, please visit our website at wgxc.org/donate. Or call us at 518-697-7400. And please consider setting up a recurring monthly donation so we can keep our doors and your ears open. Your donation is fully tax deductible. Yay! Again, our website is wgxc.org/donate. And our phone number is 518-697-7400. And now on to our regularly scheduled program. You're listening to WGXE's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane. I'm here with Hudson filmmaker David McDonald to talk about his latest screenplay based on jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald's time in the Hudson's Correctional Facility. Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
That's good.
So tell us a little bit. Ella Fitzgerald has this very colorful life, and you know, the early part of her life is colorful because it's so traumatic. Can you tell us a little bit about Ella's life before she came to Hudson?
Well, I had, I'm just like everybody else. I really didn't know much about Ella Fitzgerald at all. I've always liked her music, but, you know, it's something of a different era in some respects. And so she's on my playlist on Spotify, but, you know, not hugely. I just found out about her story while living in Hudson. I was actually working at the newspaper a few years ago, and you just hear these stories. And I became acquainted with the work some people in Hudson called the Prison Public Memory Project were doing, and had unearthed all these stories, not just the Ella story, but all of these stories from the Hudson Training School for Girls, which was a sort of juvenile detention home in Hudson that lasted, I think, until the 60s, if I'm correct. And they found, well, originally, a reporter from the New York Times wrote an article about it in the mid-80s, I believe, a woman named Sheila Eisenberg. And Tracy Hewling, who runs the Prison Public Memory Project, must have picked up on that and started doing research with this team of people who are absolutely amazing and went through whatever records they could find. But this happened in 1933. Now, it's not 2019. It's 80 years ago. So the interesting thing about doing this kind of historical research is that nobody's alive anymore. It's all secondhand, thirdhand, fourthhand stuff. My grandmother worked at blah, blah, blah. So they weren't given a whole lot of material to start with. But what they did discover is beautiful and interesting.
The prison itself, when it was opened, was considered a more humane sort of progressive prison at the time.
Well, it's sort of interesting because once I started, okay, so we know if you say 1 to 10, the amount of details you have about this story, we're at about 2.5. They know that she was sent there in 1933, and they know that she escaped. She escaped after almost a year. They have some illustrations of the garden. It looks like a country club, but the black girls and the white girls were segregated from each other, but they were wearing dresses. It's really cool. Go to the library.
Fitzgerald was not even allowed to join the choir because it was an all-whites choir.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I decided what, so they know that she was there and she escaped. They don't know if she, they speculate that she sang in something. Someone said that she might have sung. There was some relation to the church. You know, but it's all
kind of lost to myth.
Exactly. So, you know, just as a person who always sort of gets my energy from the places I live, as you know, I made a movie about the town of Woodstock. that unearthed all these things about Birdcliff and the Maverick. You know, I just sort of let this stuff gestate in my brain. I walk around town. I think about it. I actually walked up to the prison, almost got arrested. You know, wanted to see what it looked like, thought about it. There's a church up there. You know, there's the big mansion in the back.
It's actually a really lovely campus.
Yeah. I mean,
it's, you know, as outside of the razor wire.
Yeah. But it's interesting. Let me just explain. So I started thinking about it. Like, okay, how did she escape? Who could she have escaped with? Who might have helped her escape? That's so weird. Like 2 weeks after she escaped, this is so far-fetched, it's almost unbelievable. But 2 weeks after she escaped back to Harlem, where she had been living before. She had been working as
a lookout at a bordello.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's been snapped up by the cops and sent up to Hudson. Escaped back to Harlem. 2 weeks after her escape, a friend, they're having the first ever amateur night at the Apollo Theater. A friend goes with her, her best friend. Her best friend wants to dance. Ella had wanted to be a dancer. So Ella couldn't dance. So the best friend performs at this thing and cajoles Ella into singing. And Ella didn't even think of herself as a singer. She sings. The crowd goes nuts. There's an orchestra leader in the crowd named Chick Webb. He falls in love with her. He's like a dwarf. He's like 4 feet tall. It's so strange. If you see pictures of Chick Webb.
Not that we have anything against.
No.
Little people.
But it's actually touching to see, because she's like 6 foot. She looks like a linebacker. There are pictures of the two of them. She towers over him. So clearly there was some sort of mental, spiritual connection between these two. So Ella gets paroled by the state of New York to the Chick Webb Orchestra. So how did all this forgiveness happen by the state of New York as well? If she had escaped. So all this stuff happens. She performs at the amateur night at the Apollo Theater. She gets signed to his orchestra. She gets paroled to his orchestra. And 6 months later, they have this hit song called A Tisket a Tasket, which I'm sure we've all heard. And, you know, she never, ever talked about this for the rest of her life. Now, for me, as a writer, I'm also someone who's a reader, right? So I've read all the books about Hudson and Diamond Street and Hudson. And I'm thinking to myself, this happened in 1933. This is the Sin City here. This is the city that since the whaling days has been filled with prostitution, gambling halls, bars, and churches, which is weird. So you commit your sin and then you go get forgiveness at the church. But I wonder if there was any back and forth, because they talk about all this abuse that was going on at the Hudson Training School for Girls. And I'm guessing, you know, considering the dearth of employment here now, it must have been just as bad back then. So did these guys who are prison guards, and that's another thing, because almost every administration in Hudson over the last centuries has had some relationship to the prisons, because there are like two or three prisons that surround the town. So I started sort of in my brain was like, okay, there was abuse. There are a lot of rumors of abuse. I wonder if these guards were like security guards at the whorehouses too. And I wonder if there's any sort of back and forth, like if you got out of the training school and you moved over to Diamond Street or vice versa, or whether there was any sort of human trafficking going on.
I believe when I sat through a lecture at the Prison Public Memory Project, they did talk about that sometimes. And sometimes actually the girls would just go out and sort of see boys in town. I mean, there was
right.
some socializing that was going on then.
Yeah. And so I started, you know, I knew that, like, I've seen enough prison movies and prison stories. Like, there are some cliches, like Cool Hand Luke, the crazy abusive, you know, chief prison guard, etc. I wanted to, so I took some, you know, I guess normal prison story cliches, and I sort of fabricated the story in my brain about all this stuff. And in my mind, what's the Bronson House? Okay, I am an avid walker.
And here you're talking about the Oliver Bronson House, which is adjacent to the
yeah, but
property.
It's also part of the property. And like people speculate, you know, they did a a show there a few years ago, and they were like, Ella Fitzgerald lived here, or she was put here. And they had pictures of Ella Fitzgerald. And I'm like, you know, the mythologizing that goes on in a town like this, who the hell came up with that idea? I'm sure she didn't live in that house, but who did? Was it the warden of the prison? Was it the prison doctor? So I wanted to incorporate, like, I'd like to use, I got this idea in my head that I'll try to raise money and I'll film this in Hudson. And we'll, you know, also, it's 2019, Donald Trump's in office, all this racist stuff is going on. Mm-hmm. What an amazing metaphor for this year. Like, this story of this black girl being imprisoned for vile reasons and escaping.
Well, and let's talk about the reasons that she was in prison for a second, because there was some trauma, not just at the prison, but before. Her mother had died in a car accident. She went to live with her mother's boyfriend. He was apparently possibly abusive, although we don't
know. Everyone speculates.
That's kind of speculation. She ran away from home, and that's when she became the lookout at the bordello and got picked up by the police, possibly during a raid, and sent up to Hudson. So that, in and of itself, is a very traumatic youth. Then to come up to a women's prison.
This girl couldn't catch a break, man.
Eventually she did catch a break.
Right.
But for a while, she wasn't catching a break. But that's the kind of trauma that stays with you. Do you find echoes of this period in her music as you try to listen to it?
You know, that's the interesting thing, because she was such a gentle woman. And, you know, there's this wonderful, famous story about Marilyn Monroe. Ella was, I think it was one of the big clubs in New York City, and she wanted to get a month-long residency there. And what was the name? The Stork Club, I think, something like that. And they'd never had a black artist doing a residency there before. And Marilyn Monroe decided that she would go sit in the front of the audience for however long, a week in a row, 2 weeks in a row, just to sort of give Ella an air of authenticity. We grew up, you know, I'm 57, and we grew up with the Ella Fitzgerald Memorex commercials. She was a grande dame. She was like the most elegant woman. You could never imagine her talking trash or being in a jail or anything like that. So I think that adds an element of poignancy to the story, because this is not someone who is a bad ASS. You know, this was like a...
Well, and it's, you know, it also speaks to the way that we incarcerate people. It doesn't mean that they're bad people. And that
right.
does, that mark does tend, it didn't tend to with Ella Fitzgerald. She is an exception to the rule. But, you know, people tend to be marked by their time in prison, so that when they come out, every job application and every housing application, you know, it becomes something that you have to overcome.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, no. And you know, I can't even imagine what it was like for her. So, you know, in my vision of this jail, you've got these jailers who couldn't give a damn, who basically are moonlighting from their jobs as security guards at the whorehouses a few blocks away. And so, and they're trying to make a buck, like everyone is trying to make a buck. But back to your question about whether this was a reform prison. There are so many interesting elements, because the warden of the jail was a woman, and she was sort of considered a reformer of that era. And the question then asks, and something I address in the screenplay, is did she not know what these male guards were doing and what they were trying to get away with? You know, you've got the male guards. So I was just trying to add life and interest to the story, because it's also speculative. And then it's an interesting element, too, because as a writer, you know, the Ella Fitzgerald we know is a stoic, right? She's not someone who would have bitched or moaned or complained about what was going on. So I then had to address that as a writer, like, how does one write a character who's not a big talker? So in my screenplay, I gave her a foil, a girl named Alice, who's sort of a young, slightly younger, smaller, because Ella was like a 6 feet tall. She was a big girl. Alice is the sort of foil that you get in movies sometimes. So I'm, you know, also dealing with cliches and again, she can't be someone who's complaining. She has to be in the screenplay someone who sort of endures, and that's the theme of it.
Right. And that is part of that's part of the trauma of prison. Like, there is actually, you know, field of psychology that covers this. Once you go to prison and you have spent some time there, you know, the chemistry, the wiring of your brain kind of changes. You're in this totally different social structure, and that stays with you for years afterwards, well into your life.
Yeah, it's amazing that she did not become embittered, and she did sort of, I think in her private life, sort of fell in love with guys who were not very good for her and dumped them, like. Dump them.
You don't have to go to prison for that. That's
That's kind of a universal part of the human condition.
There's another interesting element of this whole story, which is maybe a year or two later. Again, it's all sort of speculative, but there was a prison public memory discovered this black doctor in Harlem. And this was in 1935. And I'm sort of, I didn't originally put him into the screenplay, but he might be a really interesting foil. And he might have been the person who helped her escape in my screenplay. There was this black doctor who was like a boat. He had a yacht, and he would take the yacht up, and he was heavily involved with the fledgling NAACP, and he was a prison reform guru. And he got out at Hudson, and he made this whole scene about the conditions at the New York Training School for Girls. And so that's very interesting, too. Also, how free were they? Could they walk around town? You said that they were dating guys in town. Was the front door open? We don't know. We don't know any of it.
Right. A lot of upstate prisons were sort of minimum security at that point. I believe that there's one down in New Paltz that you could sort of walk in and out of, and you had a key to your own.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
also, you know, it's like I'm writing a prison drama. I'm sort of, you know, I have to add drama to my screen. It can't be just like nothing happening. So there's abuse. I'm speculating about the abuse. I'm speculating
about
the abuse is
on record, not necessarily to Ella Fitzgerald, because we've kind of lost those records, but that there was what we would consider abuse at the prison is you know, part of the historical record.
Yeah.
So that does exist.
But then okay, I just want to switch subjects because mm-hmm. I know we have limited amount of time here. Mm-hmm. So the original idea was I wrote it as a screenplay. Why do I write it as a screenplay and not as a documentary? Because these days, as a documentarian, it's become so much involved with legal stuff. When I
good catch there.
Yeah, I mean, no one could have made the Woodstock movie now because you would have had to sign a release form for 500,000 people, et cetera, et cetera. Every documentary involved tons of paperwork. I had written a screenplay about Marc Chagall's life in High Falls just to license the use of Marc Chagall's paintings would have been exorbitant. So I started writing screenplays partly because its story writing process doesn't matter to me whether it's a documentary or a narrative film. I'm a writer. It's all about story structuring, putting the stories together. So for me, to write a screenplay gives me actually ownership of the story. Now, it's an interesting question in this particular era because there's a lot of discussion about cultural appropriation and whether, as a white guy, I even have a right to write this story. And that's a subject that we could talk about for an hour.
How do you feel about that? I mean, you are a white filmmaker. This is a black woman's story. If there was a black female screenwriter who said, you know, actually, I'd kind of like to take the reins on this, your response?
Okay, well there it's a myriad. How much time do we have? Myriad answers here.
We have plenty of time. You have 1 minute.
Do I literally have 1 minute? The story belongs to everyone. I happen to be living here. I felt it in my bones. The reason that I wanted to switch it from a film that I owned, that I managed, that I directed, etc., is because I want to involve the community in this project. I would actually like to be the person shepherding this project and have people of all color, black, white, Puerto Rican, etc., doing this as a community project, as a big middle finger to Donald Trump. I would like every community in America to be working on their own version of Ella the Ungovernable.
David McDonald, thank you so much for joining us.
Good use, you're done your duty. Now, men, comes that salt and vinegar female department. The chick who really purrs in the deep purple manner, Ella Fitzgerald. But hold everything, Ella, while I dig some of the scribblers who have scratched and request for you. T5 Raphael Merriweather. Corporal Ernest E. Baxter. Well, another Ernest. Greetings, Ernie. T5 J.C. Johnson, Private Leon Stewart. Private William R. Brown and Private Charlie Kerr. Ella, sprinkle the boys with that logo you put in the Hall of Immortality.
kiss on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking on down the avenue, but not a single thing to do. She went a-peck-a-peck-a-pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, she took it, my little yellow basket. And if she doesn't bring it back, I think that I will die. Don't return it, don't know what I'll do. But gee, I wonder where my basket can be.
Halloween.
Oh dear, I wish that little girl I could see.
Halloween.
The basket was a joy of mine. Lost my yellow basket. Won't someone help me find my basket? Make me happy again, again. No. No. Not the little yellow basket.
This is your At Issue host, John Kane, reminding you once again that this is our Radio for Open Ears pledge drive. And if you enjoy the programming on WGXC, you should go online to donate at wgxc.org/donate. Or you can give us a call at 518-697-7400. When you do donate, please consider a recurring donation. You can donate as little as $5 to $10 a month to help us keep our doors open and our programming active. Thank you very much. Up next, we have Third Ward resident and Common Council candidate John Darby talking about his time and experience as an Airbnb host. You're listening to WGXC's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane. I am joined by John Darby, Hudson resident of the Third Ward and currently the admissions director of the Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School. John, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. So, John, you and I met because I was tracking a short-term rental issue that seems to be something of a hot topic right now in Hudson. And you are an Airbnb host.
Yep.
As well as a Third Ward resident. And you wanted to come on to give a different side of the story as opposed to the opponents of Airbnb in town.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am a host, and I host, and the reason I'm concerned about this is I feel like all hosts are sort of being cast as like these evil villains, and there's only a few people and they own 20 houses each, and a lot of numbers are being thrown around that just don't really reflect the registration numbers that actually that people have registered for the city. And so I actually depend on the extra money I get from hosting Airbnb to pay my mortgage and pay my high taxes here in Hudson. And I feel like that's just a piece of the conversation that just never happens. The opponents seem to be blind to that piece, thinking everyone, I do think it's a way to home ownership and for bringing money back into the local economy.
Now, when you say you are using it to pay your mortgage, do you own one single unit that you Airbnb a room out of, or are you? Is this a whole separate unit?
I own two townhouses that are not townhouses, row houses on 8th Street that are connected. Mm-hmm. My dad, actually, I keep him in the one next door, and it's the way he's old and he's not very well, and that's the way sort of we are able to keep him at home with me and him independent. So sometimes on the weekends, we rent out where the row house where he lives. He comes and stays with me. Sometimes we rent them both out and stay in a motel, mm-hmm. and it's the way we... It's his income.
Now, did you purchase these homes before Airbnb became
I purchased the first one before Airbnb sort of really existed. I lived in the city, and it was I bought it as a second home 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I became really good friends with a next door neighbor, and he was an elderly gentleman, and he really wanted me to have his home when he died. And he didn't leave it to me in his will, but he sort of like instructed his family to sell it to me. So I was able to buy it.
So you took that over and decided to move your dad.
Right. I mean, initially it was, I had grand, I thought about combining the two, but then I didn't really want to do that. And,
Once you start constructing things in Hudson, the cost escalate pretty quickly.
And then things happened with my dad too. He became unwell. And so it was just a good place for him to be.
Wonderful.
So I'm concerned about, banning all Airbnbs or just owner occupancy, because that would actually impact me. Like, my dad wouldn't be able to be with me anymore. And I just think it's a complicated issue. Then
or your dad would be a little too close, maybe.
That's true.
That's fair as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you and I recently attended a legal committee meeting together where people were discussing, their various issues with Airbnb or their experiences as hosts. So the Hudson Legal Committee, you might refer to the Common Council, mm-hmm. a bill that would start to limit some of the more egregious violations, we might say, of Airbnb hosts and kind of limit their impact on the housing market in town.
Right.
What was your take on that meeting?
I'm not opposed at all to regulation. And, if someone has more than one home, I'm not saying this definitely, but maybe the tax should be more on the second home or the third home. I did a little research after that and looked at who was registered in Hudson, how many was registered for short-term rentals. Mm-hmm. There's only one person in Hudson who has 5 registered properties. There's 7 who have 4. And then there are the rest have 1 registered.
I mean, I know my landlord has 18.
Does he have 18 properties or houses? Or
I believe
18?
It's 21 units on 18 properties.
But could it be rooms in a house? Or
that's a lot of. I mean, it's 18 units.
Okay.
I know, and that might be on the same property. But that does also speak to the fact that the registration. I mean, you have to register yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or your neighbor has to turn you in.
Right. I mean, I can't really. Right now, it's self-regulated. Like, I hope everyone's an honest player. I have my 2 places.
I know everyone is honest with their taxes.
Yeah. I register my 2 places. And, I think that that's a separate issue. If people are not registering or not paying their taxes, I'm not sure how to solve that, but I don't think banning it completely because there are a few bad players is the answer. That's just sort of like throwing baby out with the bathwater, in my opinion.
No. Yeah. That is a fair point. What do you think is, listening to the experience of some people, I'm a renter in Hudson. I'm paying actually a fairly decent amount right now for an off-season Airbnb rental just so that I have a place to stay. But I'm looking at rentals at 1 bedrooms for $1,400 a month. This is much higher than our area median income.
Absolutely.
I mean, people are getting pushed out of Hudson.
Right. I'm deeply concerned about that. But I think a piece of that, though, is looking at also like what our tax rate is. Like I do think Airbnb probably has some piece of it, but if you actually start looking at the numbers, it can't be really more than 5% from what people have registered. 5% of all housing units in Hudson, it's probably more like 2%. Mm-hmm. So to blame the entire thing on Airbnb, I think, is a little bit unfair. Now I do, but and I think it is important to look at the tax number. Like if you look, the median house cost in Hudson to buy a home is roughly 189,000. I may have that wrong. It's around $189,000. The payment on that would be around.
Is that by in the city of Hudson or in the zip code of 12534?
I think the city of Hudson. I did quick facts on.
It does
census.
Get a little confusing because Greenport and part of Stockport are also in their zip code. Yeah.
I mean, it also seems like it's probably higher than that for the medium cost of a house. And I think that's probably on the low end, 189.
Right.
But even if you look at that, the payment on that, the mortgage payment is if you pay 20% down, and then the mortgage payment would be roughly $700 or $600. And the taxes before the tax hike that we all got the assessments yesterday would be another $700. That's roughly $1,400 a month.
Right.
The medium income here is $33,000. That means a take home of $2,000 a month.
Right.
So, yeah.
And yet, when Airbnb investors come in and they're snatching up housing, that does drive up the cost.
Well,
of
I wonder if that there are 5. There's the person who has 5. There's a few handful of people who have 2. I don't know if it's a fair assessment to say they're snatching up the houses, because they might be, it may be people who bought, they're moving here, or they've converted a two family into a one family. Like, it's just, I do think it plays a small, it probably plays a small part, but just the total focus of some of the opponents is like, this is the only reason. And I think that what could really happen is if you got rid of Airbnb, the adjustment of the rents might be a bit, $100 or $200 a month. But if you look, like, no one can buy a $189,000 house and like rent it for $500 a month. Their costs are at least $1,400 a month.
Right. And agreed. I mean, Airbnb hosts, we only have, you know, it's 100 and something hotel rooms in the city of Hudson. Airbnb makes up the vast majority of the rooms and the beds that feed the lodging tax. Right. And that is an issue. If we pull the rug out from under tourism, we are pulling the rug out from our local economy.
Absolutely. And it also impacts every business on Warren Street, families that depend on the income from those small businesses. It could have huge economic impact. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that I think that it's not focused on is the percentage of owner-occupied units, housing units in Hudson. It's only 35%. That is inverse of what it is in America, which is 65% ownership. And ownership of a home is the best way to build wealth in America.
Traditionally, that's not necessarily. You know, I used to work in mortgages, and they always said the value of your house will never go down. The value of your house will never go down. And then
and it can go down.
And then 2008, yes.
But generally, if trends stay the same, I mean, I do think though, like, I brought that up the other night at the meeting with the mayor. And that's something that I think the entire town should be focused on. Like, the number of, like, getting more home ownership here. Like, we're in a unique opportunity to do that here. Like, there should be tax incentives for first-time homeowners. Like, really focus on that, because I think that could change the equation. And also, think of Airbnb as a way to home ownership. Like, you can rent your home on Airbnb for a few days a month and cover your mortgage. So,
Or at least help with your mortgage.
You're right. At least help with your mortgage.
Right.
So I mean, just that piece of the conversation just is, everyone seems to have blinders to that, and it's concerning.
Well, I do think, and I do see some variation. I mean, there are some people who just think Airbnb is awful and we need to get rid of them, and this is a city for us and not for our visitors. And I do think that there is, I do think that those people do have blinders on. You are correct. But there are a lot of people who recognize that if you have a spare room in your house and you're trying to make rent or make a mortgage payment, you know, that's totally fine. That is the place that you live. Although I would point out that for a lot of people where you might have a roommate, you now just have an empty room most of the month. And that is also impactful to the housing market. I mean, these are probably more complicated issues than we as a city of 6,000 people have a budget to deal with. So we kind of have to roll the dice and make a call somewhere. The question is, you know, when is the right time and where is the right place to throw those dice?
And again, I'm not opposed to regulating. And, you know, I don't know what the number of, like, a fair amount. But, you know, I'm sure there are people who inherit their parents' house across the street that they shouldn't necessarily have to be forced to sell that or rented it below market rate to. Yeah, I think it's really complicated. And we have to look at all that. And we shouldn't just, you know, have blind punitive damaging legislation that hurts people.
You know, to my mind, though, if you are buying an investment property, you know, your return to that property, your return in that property, your payoff in that property comes when you sell it. It doesn't necessarily come month to month. You know, you are making, you know, the value of houses has skyrocketed.
Right. You're usually just covering cost with rental.
Right. And I mean, there is something.
I mean,
to be
honestly,
said.
If I didn't have my father, it's not like this is a huge money maker. It works for my life situation at the moment.
Right. Although the way that property values have gone up and looking at assessments, maybe it is a money maker for you. Who knows? You'll probably be challenging that. You know, area median income, you noted, was $33,000 a year.
There may be a little bit more than that.
Yeah, and there are some upward estimates of that. That number is a little bit wobbly. Tourism is one of the major employers right now. You know, state government and the hospital are two others. You know, what do we do to diversify our economy to get the area median income up? Because that one way is to, you know, if we want to get people into housing, one great way to do that is to increase their income potential.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, you know, Hudson is a very small, unique, very progressive place. Why aren't our city council talking about a living minimum wage? Like, that's something that we could talk about. Like, I just think that that discussion should happen. I don't have the answer for what the next economy, like the economy driver in Hudson should be, but something has organically come out of tourism, and tourism has grown mostly organically. So I think we should cultivate that, but in a responsible way.
The lodging tax that has been paid so far, I would add also that Airbnbs do not pay a sales tax that hotels do pay.
Right. And maybe we should.
And that is, is something that could certainly be looked at. But Airbnbs and hotels have both paid into a lodging tax that has gone to fund a tourism committee. Recently, somebody had pointed out that with a $250,000 budget over 2 years and a maximum of $250,000 in their kitty for a year, this makes them essentially a very large, somewhat decent-sized, I apologize, it's not a very large, it's a decent-sized department within the city of Hudson. They are currently working on branding the city of Hudson. Is that the best use of funds? Is that of the most value to the residents of Hudson?
Well, you know, if I had been writing the legislation, that's probably not what I would have earmarked the money for. The answer is probably not. There's right. probably other things that that money could be better used for.
Right, but a relic of a different political climate, and that was just what had to be made.
Yeah.
But how do we spend it? How do we spend the money that is currently available?
Right. Well, I think one could, but when you start talking about building new houses, it's not that's still not a lot of money. Yeah. But certainly, it seems like that money should be funded back into improving the housing stock here in Hudson. Mm-hmm. I think we definitely need to be like tracking more closely. We talk a lot about short-term rental regulation. I think the long-term rental there's registration, but getting those numbers, like there's no list as easy to access as there is for the short term. So we don't really know how many it's not easy to access, like how many houses are being converted from two family that were one family that became three family, but now being converted back to one family, what the rents are actually being charged. Like the city's not tracking that in any way. And I think like focusing on that is huge in regulating the long-term rental stocks, particularly when it's 65% of all the units here, that needs to be focused on.
Although,
and getting that back into owner.
Perversely, if we start regulating long-term rentals too much, a lot of landlords might just say, forget this, I'm going to use it as short-term rentals.
True.
That's true.
But it does seem like there's something's off balance with so much regulation on the short-term rental market, and then when most of the housing units in Hudson are long-term rental, and there's almost no regulation around that.
Well,
there's some regulation. I shouldn't say there's no regulation. There is regulation.
And there's also a lot of vacant units that are owned by...
Right. We have a recipe here, I think. And
right.
What's happened is many years, we might as well say it, like slumlords, like were able to operate with the lack of legislation or the lack of registration and what we had around long-term rentals, which is not good.
Right. Right, and so we need to remedy that by a good question.
when
exactly, be taken up.
Good question.
as you are interested in housing, that is certainly one of the hot-button issues that is going to be coming up this year and probably for the next couple of years in the city of Hudson. You have decided to petition to run for alderman in the 3rd Ward.
I have, yes.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about the genesis of that campaign?
I started following things more closely, what was going on in the Common Council. Or not what
it's
was going on.
It's super fun, isn't it?
It's super fun. It's actually it's better than anything on television. Yeah, it is fun to follow. What's being said, who seems to have the loudest voices, which one of our aldermen are speaking in the meetings and which are driving things and which don't seem to be driving anything and just voting as a block with other people. And I do find that it's been fascinating to watch. As I've gone out, like getting the names of petitions, people didn't always know who their aldermen were. They didn't know who their aldermen were. They were also signing petitions to get aldermen on the board, on the ballot,
Council, yeah.
And not knowing who they were actually signing up for. I'm not sure I did either in the past. So I've just started paying attention and I want to be a part of this whole group. I've had some experiences in my life that I think, and develop certain skills that I think will be help. I could be of help. Maybe.
Well, the 3rd Ward is going to be a pretty heavily contested this year. I believe that there are currently 4 that I'm aware of. There might be 5 people running for 2 slots. That actually might be the most contested ward. What do you feel makes you stand out from the pack?
Well, I talk a lot. And I think I'll like connect with my neighbors. Like I hope if I was elected, like no one would be like, say, living in the third ward would be like, who's my alderman? I think that would make me very much different.
Excellent. John Darby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me in.